You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. In Eboo Patel's new book, Pluralism, Prejudice, and the Promise of America, he writes about the controversy over the proposed Muslim-inspired interfaith project in Lower Manhattan and the ensuing demonizing of our Muslim neighbors by exemplars of bigotry. Ed Bacon, in his new book, The Eight Habits of Love, talks about the habit of candor, taking the courage to engage in difficult conversations. How do we speak to others of different faiths? What binds us together, and how can we improve our interfaith literacy, our intimate interfaith relationships? In each of our authors' books tonight, I found resonance with what we try to do right here at Aloud, to practice the habit of community, to share ideas so that we counter our central fear, as Reverend Bacon says, the fear that we are essentially alone in the world. So let us embark tonight on an evening of listening, thinking, and talking together about the pluralism that is, as Eboo Patel says, at the heart of the American project. To guide us in that conversation are two truly extraordinary men. Eboo Patel is the founder and president of the Interfaith Youth Corps, which works to facilitate interfaith bridge building among young people by involving them in service projects around the globe. He is the author of Acts of Faith, and his new book is, as mentioned, Sacred Ground, Pluralism, Prejudice, and the Promise of America. He was a member of President Obama's inaugural Faith Council and is a regular contributor to the Washington Post, Huffington Post, CNN, and Public Radio. He holds a doctorate in the sociology of religion from Oxford University, where he studied on a Rhodes Scholarship. The Reverend L. Edwin Bacon, Jr., whom many of you know, has been the rector of All Saints Church, Pasadena, since 1995. All Saints is a multi-ethnic urban Episcopal parish with a reputation for energetic worship, progressive peace and justice work, and a radically inclusive spirit. Ed has been honored several times for his peace and interfaith work, including recognition from the Islamic Center of Southern California, the ACLU of Southern California, the Islamic Shura Council, and the Pasadena NAACP. He's a regular host on Oprah's Radio Soul series and a contributor to Oprah.com. And his new book is Eight Habits of Love, Open Your Heart, Open Your Mind. And that's what we'll do now. Please welcome Reverend Ed Bacon and Eboo Patel. Thank you.
Thanks. Good evening, everyone, and thanks for being here. I am very excited to be with my newest best friend, Eboo Patel. I've had a wonderful time reading his book and very excited about having a conversation with him and then drawing you into that conversation. One of the delights about Eboo's book is his disclosing something of his own spiritual practice, particularly during the holy season of Ramadan. He had me when he said that prior to entering the day, he would get up, have his small breakfast, and then have a time with a poem by Rumi. Rumi's one of my favorite poets, and I thought it would be really wonderful if we all could have a kind of a moment of centering around Eboo reading one of his favorite Rumi poems. How's that sound? All right.
Thank you for that invitation. Thank you all for being here. So this is a poem that I actually first heard in Konya, where Rumi is buried in Turkey. Come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, it doesn't matter. Ours is not a caravan of despair. Come, even if you have broken your vows 1,000 times. Come yet again. Come. couple reasons that this is meaningful to me. It's actually in the book Sacred Ground, and I say that whenever I look at the Statue of Liberty, right, this great, this beautiful woman of welcoming, the inscription is, bring me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, right? It's this notion of America in radical welcoming and openness. Bring your traditions, plant those seeds in American soil, and let them grow into institutions and into congregations that are welcoming and open to others. And so that spirit of welcoming and openness that I think is at the heart of the American tradition, I think is at the heart of Islam as well. And nobody articulates that better or more beautifully than Rumi.
So I need to confess that I get emotional when I talk with people like Eboo about the issues that we're going to be addressing tonight, particularly the issue of interfaith relations and also the issue of the idea of America. Right after 9/11, several of us, a lot of us, gathered at a mosque here near USC. And I heard a sentence that changed my life. And it was this: to be religious in the 21st century is to be interreligious. And it is that dedication that draws me to Eboo and the way he thinks. So I'm going to apologize only once for being emotional about these things. If I get choked up, you'll just say, you can chalk it up to that. But one of the great moments in his book is his telling about the Genesis moment for this book. So Eboo, would you?
Sure. So this is actually Ramadan 2010. It's August of that year. So I'm waking up at around 4 a.m. and I'm having my last meal before doing my prayers that begin the time of fasting. And it's at that point that I like to, as Muslims do, to read more from the Quran or read from Rumi or just additional time of centering and meditation. Muslims believe that God listens extra closely during those dawn hours. But instead, if people remember what was happening in August of 2010, it was the crazy discourse we were having around Cordoba House or the Ground Zero Mosque. And so I'm not reading Rumi. I'm not reading the Quran. I'm literally on right-wing hate website after right-wing hate website trying to anticipate the storyline of the day. Because every day there are new attacks on Imam Faisal and Daisy Khan, who are the founders of Cordoba House. And there's, you know, new word about this being a terrorist command center, et cetera, et cetera. These are people that I've known for many years, the people who I admire, who've spoken of building an institution supported by the Muslim community that would be of service to the entire nation. And Cordoba House was the fruit of their vision. And so I'm, you know, basically trying to figure out if I get called by CNN or whoever else, what am I going to say? And that's when I see my name, Eboo Patel, Muslim extremist. Eboo Patel, Muslim radical. Eboo Patel, Muslim terrorist. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm the dude who founded the Interfaith Organization. And really? Me? You know? And it was at that time, I felt like I was teetering between anger and despair, right? I thought that America had entered the twilight zone happily, our nation wanted to believe the ugliest, hateful, most twisted lies about a religion that's 1,400 years old and that has 1.5 billion adherents around the world. And it was not a particularly happy or spiritually enhanced Ramadan for me. So a couple days into, I think, the second week of Ramadan, I get a phone call from Sheikh Hamza Youssef, who is a spiritual mentor in my life and, you know, maybe the most well-known Muslim preacher in America, especially within Muslim circles. And he kind of plays a St. Francis of Assisi role in my life, and he also plays kind of the mad scientist in Back to the Future movies. You know, and he'll kind of jump into my life, he'll call me, he'll tell me I have to read a book or go to a conference, and then he'll disappear. So he calls and he says, Salaamu Alaikum Eboo, Ramadan Kareem, Wa Alaikum Assalam Sheikh Hamza, Ramadan Kareem, how are you doing? And I'm like, I'm doing terrible. You know, I can't believe what's happening to Imam Faisal and Daisy in the media. I can't believe that they're calling what is effectively a Muslim YMCA a terrorist command project. And Sheikh Hamza, who is not one to hold his fire, right, says something that turns my world around. He says, you're getting this all wrong. These aren't the moments to be angry or despairing. These are the moments that change agents yearn for. Our nation is molten and can be shaped. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he said, listen, we have known that there is an ignorance around Islam in America. And we've also known that there are these really ugly forces of prejudice who want to repeat the lies and hatred of the Al-Qaedas of the world. Now it's out in the open. And what happens when an ugly prejudice is out in the open is the better angels of American nature come out and engage those and defeat those. And you, especially the work you do at Interfaith Youth Corps, you have to do your work well at this point. And then it click, and he was gone, right? That's the mad scientist from the Back to the Future movies part. That's when I started thinking, you know, that we actually have this really beautiful dynamic across American history where the forces of prejudice, whether it's Peter Stuyvesant in the 1650s or the anti-Catholic and anti-Jewish forces through, you know, much of the 18th, 19th, and early 20th century, will try to marginalize a community. And other people, who I call in sacred ground, the forces of pluralism, will stand up and defeat them. And this was our chance to write our version of that chapter in American history. And it was actually a great honor to be able to be a part of that. And that was the beginning of the book.
So we just kind of breathe that in, right? That leads you to an exploration of what I think is a really radical notion and a correct understanding of the essence of America, the idea of America, which interestingly enough resonates with something the Prophet Muhammad said.
Right.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so there's this beautiful line from the Prophet Muhammad that Muslims follow that by saying, peace and blessings of God be upon him. It's the hadith literature, which are the sayings of the Prophet. None of you truly believes until he wants for his brother or his fellow what he wants for himself, right? And in my mind, I connect that with one of the sayings of the caliph and Imam Ali, who's the fourth of the caliphs and the first of the Shia imams, who sends a letter to his governor in Egypt and says, everybody there is either your brother in faith or your equal in creation. And in this notion is central, I think, to both Islam and America, right? That we have to lift up and emphasize the dimensions of our traditions that build relationships with people different from us. It's this notion of not only radical openness, but faith and nation as a bridge of cooperation rather than a barrier of division or a bomb of destruction. And there are powerful movements out there making especially faith a bomb of destruction or a barrier of division. And a big part of what you're about in your church in Pasadena, a big part of what we're about at Interfaith Youth Corps, a big part of what Reverend Danny Fisher and the folks who are here from MPAC, and you know, I have a lot of friends in this room, a big part of what they're about and what they're doing is making faith a bridge of cooperation. So I'd love to read a selection from Sacred Ground about how I think that America is a nation that this is woven into our DNA, and I view it as the achievement not just of the American promise, but also something really beautiful from Surah 49 of the Holy Quran, where God says, I made you different nations and tribes that you may come to know one another. We have the chance to achieve that in America, and I kind of write that in the final passage of the introduction of Sacred Ground, which I'll just read to you. I profile many people in this book, but the main character is the one I love the most, America. You will see my weakness for her at every turn. She is the nation I belong to, believe in, seek to build up. She is the ultimate composite character, a character with a complex and inspiring past, a character whose future will be determined by the many characters who call her home. The strangest part of the Cordoba House debate for me was the idea of sacred ground. The people opposed to Cordoba House insisted that the blocks around Ground Zero constituted a holy area. Those who believed Cordoba House ought to stay in Lower Manhattan liked to point to the nearby strip joint and off-track betting parlor and say that this patch of land is just like any other. Why can't you just move it 10 or 20 blocks away, a CNN anchor asked me on air at the height of the controversy? But that would still be sacred ground, I thought to myself. 100 miles north, 1,000 miles south, 2,000 miles west, it's all holy. I believe every inch of America is sacred, from sea to shining sea. I believe we make it holy by who we welcome and by how we relate to each other. Call it my Muslim eyes on the American project. We made you different nations and tribes that you may come to know one another, says the Quran. There is no better place on earth than America to enact that vision. It is part of the definition of our nation. I say democracy is only of use there that it may pass on and come to its flower and fruits and manners and the highest forms of interaction between men and their beliefs in religion, literature, colleges, and schools, sang Whitman. Pluralism is not a birthright in America. It's a responsibility. Pluralism does not fall from the sky. It does not rise up from the ground. People have fought for pluralism. People have kept the promise. America is exceptional, not because there is magic in our soil, but because there is fierce determination in our citizens. The greatness of America lies not in being more enlightened than any other nation, but rather in her ability to repair her faults, says Alexis de Tocqueville. Every generation has to affirm and extend the American promise. And when I think of that promise, I think of the Christmas pageant at the Catholic school on the north side of Chicago, where my firstborn started his education. The school is an American rainbow. African, Polish, Mexican, Croatian, Indian, you name it, it's there. They are all gathered at the Christmas pageant. Miss G's three-year-olds are standing on the rickety stage, gleefully parading about in their Santa hats. Zaid, my son, is talking to his friend Lisa, the Chinese girl with the white mom and the Pakistani aunt. I am cooing in the ear of our newborn baby when the signal comes and the class starts in on their assigned song. It's a little wobbly at first, but they catch the swing soon enough, and when they hit the chorus, I can't help myself. I start to sing along. I love this melody. I love the sight of my sweet kid among all these other sweet kids. I'm remembering the sheer awe I felt on my first hike in a redwood forest, the adrenaline pumping through my veins when I hailed my first taxi on the New York Island. My sons will make their own memories on this blessed patch of earth. One day, they will realize just what it means that this land is their land and that they share it with 310 million others. When Zaid was a baby and woke up crying in the middle of the night, I would walk up and down our hallway singing him this song. It was a long time since I last sang it, maybe fifth grades, but the words came back easy, like they were written in me. There at the Christmas pageant, with my kids and my countrymen, I am bursting with pride and love. This is the American Shahada, a declaration of faith to our nation and to each other. I cry when I hear that song, so if you cry, it's all right.
It's really wonderful.
Redwood Forest, New York Island. We could sing it together, probably. We'll spare, Book TV is here, we'll spare them that.
I want you to expand on another of my favorite moments in your book when you say, the most American thing you can do is stand up for someone else.
Mm-hmm. You know, so one of the things Sheikh Hamza said before he left and, you know, vanished into thin air that day was, don't focus on just the ugliness that's coming out around Muslims. And this was a really ugly time, right? I mean, there were shots allegedly fired out of outside of a mosque in Buffalo. A Muslim cab driver was asked if he was Muslim and was stabbed four times in response. There were mosques being opposed from literally San Diego to Staten Island, from sea to shining sea. So it wasn't just this one project. It was, you know, my mom called me and she said, your kids are young, there's still time to change their names. I'm like, what are you talking about? And she's like, just think of how they're going to be treated with Muslim names. You have to give them American names. And I was like, Mom, Zaid and Khalil are American names, you know. But it was an ugly time. And Sheikh Hamza said to me in this phone call, he's like, think of all the people standing up for Muslims. And it was true, right? And I want to tell just one brief story of that I tell in the book, and I get choked up even thinking about this. So there was this young intern at Interfaith Youth Corps, college student at nearby DePaul University, and the task that we'd given him was to compile basically all of the most relevant media about anti-Muslim stuff happening during the Cordoba House madness. And he would hand me a file at the end of every day with like the, you know, with these stories all categorized so that I could prepare for whatever media we might have the next day. And it's at this time, this is now becoming the fall of 2010, that there are a couple of really ugly incidents around LGBT folks in the United States. There's the terrible suicide at Rutgers of the young Tyler Clemente. There's a terrible beating in the Bronx of a couple of young gay men. And somebody hands me, out of the blue at my office, a blog post that this young man wrote, Nick Lang. And I hadn't, you know, he was an intern at the office, and my interaction with him was basically, thanks for the file, Nick. It wasn't much more than that. And it was a piece that Nick had read about imagining his own suicide and the pills he would take, the look on his grandmother's face, and turns out Nick's gay. And I said to him, you know, I am stunned that at a time when folks who share your identity are going through violent prejudice, you are spending your time interning for free at an interfaith organization compiling news stories about prejudice against Muslims. And he looked at me. He's like 19 years old. He says, I'm committed to an America that's free for everyone. And if I want my people to be free in America, I have to build an America where everybody feels welcome, including your community. I thought that was so beautiful and so mature. And I thought to myself, you know what? That's the most American thing that you can do, is to stand up for people who are different from you. And I want Muslims to stand up for him.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. I would love to stay there. There are two or three other stories I'd like you to tell. But I see the clock, and we're going to have to move on, because I want you to say a few things about your organization. And after that, then I have another question just to kind of refine that. I have a Muslim teacher here in Los Angeles, Dr. Maher Atout, and he loves to talk about the passage from the Quran that you mentioned, that we have been given diversity as a gift so that we can learn from one another. Is that correct?
We can come to know one another.
Come to know one another. And he said, that is not about tolerance.
Right.
It is about coming to know one another. Could you take that as a kind of a launching pad for talking about
Thank you for that.
What you do
Sure.
with your organization?
So what Interfaith Youth Corps does, this organization that I'm founder and president of, and what this book, we hope, is going to help expand the field of interfaith cooperation, of which we're one organization. And in some ways, it tells the story of who we've been in the last couple of years at Interfaith Youth Corps and who we hope to be. And we think that interfaith cooperation ought to be a social norm, in the same way that volunteerism, human rights, environmentalism, multiculturalism have all become social norms. And that a particular sector, which is college campuses, ought to play a front and center role in that. And there's a number of reasons for that. One is, you know, campuses obviously advance a knowledge base for our society. And I think that, you know, that when I was in college, and my friend from grad school is here, my closest friend from grad school, Matt Fisher, who just got tenure at UCLA, and we would talk about this a lot when we were at Oxford together, was going through the multiculturalism movement on college campuses in the mid-1990s and how that had reframed our view of America as a nation where people from multiple communities had made contributions and helped advance the American project. And the one word that we heard very little about during that multicultural movement was religion, right? So there was a lot about multicultural literacy, multicultural leadership, multicultural relationships, but very little about interfaith literacy, interfaith leadership, interfaith relationships. And we think at Interfaith Youth Corps that college campuses ought to model that for the country. They ought to advance that knowledge base of interfaith literacy. They ought to be places where young people from different faith backgrounds build positive relationships with each other, where you've got a critical mass of interfaith leaders coming up that are, first of all, trained on those college campuses and then kind of move into the rest of the society, whether it's at hospitals or law firms or in seminaries, and bring that interfaith literacy and interfaith leadership to the rest of our society. We define interfaith cooperation very simply, it's building relationships between people who orient around religion differently. And some sector has to lead this, has to advance the knowledge base, has to model what good looks like, has to nurture a critical mass of interfaith leaders, right? And college campuses are the place that we think we can make the biggest difference.
So talk a little bit about this triangle. I think it's important for all of us to have this in our mind.
So this is in a chapter in the book called The Science of Interfaith Cooperation. And one of the things that I think is, as interfaith cooperation grows, and by the way, if I was in the private sector, I would say buy interfaith, right? It's, I think, like human rights or like environmentalism, it's a field that's going to grow dramatically. If you read any newspaper, you're going to see a lot of blood between the black and the white, right? And there's an unfortunate amount of that blood that is done to the soundtrack of prayer. And just to give you one example of this, one of the question that people are focusing on when it comes to the transitions of Muslim countries towards democracy and market economies are generally about governance and about economics. But frankly, there's a third key question as well, and that is, can the Christians and the Muslims of Egypt, can the Alawis and the Sunnis of Syria, can the Sunnis and the Shias of Bahrain, can the Christians and the Sunnis and Shias of Lebanon, can they build societies together? Can the Kurds and the Sunnis and Shias of Iraq, right? It's going to be a key question. This is the question of how different sects and religious communities relate to each other is going to be one of the central questions of the 21st century. That's one of the reasons we need a really robust field of interfaith cooperation, helping to make faith a bridge of cooperation rather than a barrier of division or a bomb of destruction. So anything that deserves a field deserves to have the question, how do we do this well, answered. And you can see this as a robust discourse within the field of education reform or within the field of poverty alleviation or within the field of environmentalism, right? It's not about just doing it. It's about doing it well. And so part of what we've done at Interfaith Youth Corps is look through the social science research of the last 10 years on religious diversity, whether it's work by Robert Putnam at Harvard or Robert Wethenau at Princeton or by Pew and Gallup or by Ashutosh Varshney at Brown, and all the social science research, and ask the question of effectiveness. What does this teach us about how to do interfaith cooperation well? And what you come up with is actually a very simple model. We call it the interfaith triangle. We know, based on the social science research, that if you know one person of a different religious background, if you have a single meaningful relationship with, say, a Mormon or an evangelical or a Muslim or a Jew, your attitudes towards that whole community improve. In fact, we also know from the social science data that your attitudes towards other religious communities improve, right? We also know that if you have what we call appreciative knowledge of a different religion, something as simple as being able to place the Quran or the Prophet Muhammad within Islam, that your attitudes towards that tradition improve. So those three things, attitudes, knowledge, relationships, are deeply connected. So what's an effective interfaith program? Right. This, by the way, this might sound simple and common sense, and as somebody with a PhD in the social sciences, I'm very happy to say that part of what we do for a living is derive the data that proves common sense, and in this case, it's definitely true. But you wouldn't believe how many interfaith programs I've been to where people will choose the most divisive topic imaginable, the Middle East or abortion, and they'll take people on opposite ends of the pole, put them on stage, and basically say, fight, right? And the audience leaves mad at each other, and people wonder why. You're not facilitating positive, meaningful relationships within people. You're not advancing appreciative knowledge, right? Just because you have people from different religions in a room talking about religion doesn't mean it's interfaith. In fact, given the way religious discourse goes in our society, it's a lot easier to default to arguments about divisiveness than it is to advance appreciative knowledge and meaningful relationships. So an effective interfaith program is one where somebody walks out and says, you know what, I had a conversation with a Baha'i. I didn't know much about that community. Frankly, I kind of had negative views. But after meeting Matt from that tradition, I'm going to look at that community differently. Or I learned about this, you know, beautiful line from Rabbi Hillel in Judaism. If I am only for myself, who am I? If I'm not for myself, who will be for me? If not now, when? Right? That's appreciative knowledge about that tradition. That's inspiring. Right? So A big part of what we're trying to do at Interfaith Youth Corps is train a critical mass of interfaith leaders on college campuses who will first start those programs on their campuses, right? Campuses are these really inspiring micro-civil societies in our culture where you can take a religious studies 330 class and read Ed Bacon or Eboo Patel or Robert Putnam and say, wow, that's an interesting way of doing interfaith cooperation. Walk across the quad to the Student Affairs Building and start a Better Together campaign, which is what we call our interfaith program at Interfaith Youth Corps. And you can literally have a program going in a week. One of the things I tell college students that I talk to now is the single most disorienting thing for me when I graduated from college was, you know, where are all the people running around whispering in my ear how great my idea is? Because there are people on staff at college, Reverend Danny Fisher is one of these guys at the University of the West, who are paid to tell students how great their ideas are. And can we please give you money to help make that a reality? So take advantage of that, right? Build that knowledge base of interfaith leadership. Learn those skills. Practice running those programs. And then when you become a doctor, you become an attorney, you go into politics, you come to Hollywood, it's a lot easier to facilitate positive, meaningful relationships between people from different religions and advance appreciative knowledge because you've flexed those muscles as a 19 and 20-year-old college student. Yeah. So we're looking to build that movement at Interfaith Youth Corps.
But you've had Interfaith Youth Corps for almost 10 years, and I really, you mentioned this, but I want to punctuate it for a minute because I think it's important for those of us who appreciate the value of interfaith work, interreligious knowledge and relationships. To hear the story of your going to have a steak with a good grilled steak with your friend.
Right.
Who really caught you up short and, from my reading, changed.
Yeah.
What you're doing a little bit.
Yeah, so this was not a happy afternoon. This was it was 4th of July weekend a couple of years ago, and one of our board members at Interfaith Youth Corps is a director at McKinsey & Company, and he had said to me, you know, let's do a pro bono assessment of how this organization has been doing over the first 8 years of its existence. And I was like, you know, great. Tell us, you know, spend your McKinsey money and tell us how great we're doing, right? And I didn't know that that's not how consulting generally works. So my wife had promised, as we're heading up to Tariq's house on this July 4th weekend, she's like, no shop talk. And I'm like, you know, who's talking shop? Things are going great. We're just going to have a great time looking out over the lake and enjoying steaks. So I'm out there grilling with Tariq, and he looks at me, and he's like, so I'm getting some of the data back from our assessment of Interfaith Youth Corps. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, yeah. It's not going so great. And I'm like, come again? And he's like casually flipping the steaks, and he's like, it's not going so great. I'm like, what are you talking about? I also didn't know like just how concrete consultants can get sometimes. And he's like, well, when you go speak at a college campus, people really like Interfaith Youth Corps speakers, but 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months later, they're not really taking action. And I'm like, you know, this does not sound great. And then he kind of dug the knife in. He says, and actually, I have a theory about this. And I'm like, what's your theory? And he says, my theory is it's your fault. And I'm like, I kind of wish I hadn't asked that question. And he's like, the problem, Eboo, is when you talk about interfaith cooperation, you talk about 100 different things. And the truth is people can't and won't do 100 different things. Right? You have to be able to articulate an aspirational vision of this in a way that people take action and not measure your effectiveness by the applause after speeches. The effectiveness of interfaith cooperation is how many people are becoming interfaith leaders, starting their own interfaith programs on college campuses, and then going on to vocations in interfaith leadership, not necessarily professional vocations, but as it's part of their identity, just like being a human rights activist or an environmentalist or somebody who believes in multicultural cooperation is a part of your identity, regardless of your profession, right? Being an interfaith leader ought to be a part of your identity, whether you're a lawyer or a banker or a Hollywood agent. That wasn't happening in the older version of Interfaith Youth Corps. And so we went through, I went through a period of kind of dramatic identity change as somebody who, as I was sharing this with you earlier, my question used to be, you know, what's your cool new idea? My question now is, what are you building that's going to last? Right? And we want to build an institution at Interfaith Youth Core that's going to last. And we want to be part of a movement that writes the next chapter in the glorious story of American pluralism. And in order to do that, you have to pay some attention to effectiveness. And a big part of being effective is articulating clear visions that people can take action on. So we took our 8 different interfaith leadership models and we collapsed them into a single model. We run 3 to 4 interfaith leadership institutes every year on college campuses across the country. In fact, we're just closing one right now at the University of Southern California, where several dozen students from campuses across the country are being trained to build relationships between people from different faith backgrounds, including humanists, and they go back to their college campuses and they start something called a Better Together campaign. And we have a staff of people at IFYC who are in touch with those students and supports them running the Better Together campaign. So we've kind of gone from an organization that did 12 or 15 different things. And frankly, if you're a 35-person organization doing 12 different things, there's a reasonably good chance you're not doing any of them well, to an organization that basically does 3 things, all of them against the hyper-clear goal of making interfaith cooperation a social norm through the sector of higher education. And that was a transformation for me, because I used to kind of rate my intelligence by how many times I could connect the most recent New Yorker to the Atlantic Monthly to an ancient, you know, Sanskrit tradition to contemporary America. And, you know, it sounded great from a stage, and people would leave and they'd be like, what did that dude talk about again? And what am I supposed to do? And now we, you know, want to say, we want you to be an interfaith leader. We want you to start programs on your campuses and in your communities that effectively work the interfaith triangle.
Yeah. Hence the interfaith triangle. So, I've been doing interfaith work for a long time, and I agree with you that neither the combat on stage is going to be interfaith cooperation and is not going to make it the norm, nor is sitting around having tea and cucumber sandwiches with some Jews and Muslims and Baha'is, et cetera. There has to be something where there's traction. Now, looking at this group, a good many of us have already been in college. And yet we're here to learn from you. So what about us? What about our lives? What about what we can do to transform America to have this new norm?
Right. So I think it's important for everybody to be an interfaith leader. An organization has to focus somewhere, and we've chosen our focus on college campuses for a variety of reasons. But I think everybody ought to be an interfaith leader. And I'll talk about 2 parts of this, right? One is having what I call an appreciative knowledge of other traditions, and I tell a lot of stories about this in Sacred Ground. And actually, you're an exemplar of this, right? Your practice of fasting Ramadan with other Muslims, your knowledge of Rumi, your understanding of how other people's prayer practices connects them with the divine and the ability to find resonances between your tradition and that and other people's tradition. There's, if folks remember the Ground Zero Mosque Madness from a couple years back, there was a guy who held a sign famously at an anti-Muslim rally that said, "All I need to know about Islam I learned on 9/11. And I looked at him and I thought, you know, at least you're telling the truth, right? And honestly, what much of what people know about a tradition that's 1.5 billion people around the world and 1,400 years old is the heinous, ugly terror of 9/11 and a handful of other violent incidents afterwards. And it's not that those things didn't happen or that they're not important. They're terrible. They happen. Muslims around the world have and ought to have repudiated them, but they don't represent a tradition. And if we don't know the deepest value in Islam, for example, is mercy. And devout Muslims say dozens of times a day, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, the all-merciful, the ever-merciful, right? And the first lesson of classical Muslim scholars to their students was, if you treat people on earth with mercy, the one in heaven will be merciful to you. It's appreciative knowledge about a tradition. It's the kind of thing that everybody, I think, ought to have, especially at a time when the forces of religious prejudice are loud and want to tell you that what the Al-Qaeda types are saying about Islam is true. If we don't have other knowledge than what we hear on the evening news about a religion, or frankly, religion period these days, then the folks on the evening news win. The second thing that I want to bring up is what I call in Sacred Ground a theology of interfaith cooperation. And one of the things that I've learned in 12 or 15 years of working in interfaith cooperation and getting a PhD in the sociology of religion is that the people who want to make faith a barrier of division or a bomb of destruction, the religious extremists or folks who just want to create divides, they're really good with chapter and verse. They can quote you tip of the tongue where in the Bible it says, I can't like you, or where in the Quran it says, I have to stay separate from you. And if the response of those of us in faith communities is, they win. So theologies of religious extremism and theologies of religious divisiveness are highly salient and actually very loud in our world today. And frankly, it's easy to take a couple pieces of scripture here and a couple moments in history there and a figure here and an item there and string them together and say that's Christianity. The fact is, you can do that just as easily and frankly, I believe, more justifiably in a scholarly sense around interfaith cooperation. And a good part of Sacred Ground is devoted to those stories, right? So part of what I do is I exegete or do an interpretation of the Good Samaritan story as an interfaith story. And of course, the Good Samaritan story is this kind of is maybe the archetypal Christian story of somebody left for dead by the side of the road, from the road to connecting Jerusalem and Jericho, and a priest passes him by, and a Levite passes him by. Two people from his own faith community leave him. And the person who stops, nurses him to health, brings him to an inn, tells the innkeeper, gives the innkeeper 2 days' wages, and says, if this person needs to stay here longer, I will come back and pay, is a Samaritan. Who's the Samaritan? The Samaritan is not just the marginalized person, which is how the story is generally told, or the other, the generalized other. The otherness of the Samaritan is religious in nature. The Samaritan is somebody from a different religion, right? And the story begins by the lawyer asking Jesus, how do I attain eternal life? So this is a story that is meant for the cosmic. There's a connection to the heavens here. Right? And Jesus ends the story by saying, go and do likewise. Right? So there's this beautiful moment at the center of the Christian scriptures, just as there are moments at the center of Islam and Judaism, etc., where the founders of our faith traditions are saying, follow the ethic of the person who prays differently and who, frankly, has beliefs we disagree with, but in this case is modeling the ethic better than we could ourselves.
Yeah. The fault line that you just referred to is a very powerful moment for me in your book. Early in my life in the interfaith community in Los Angeles, there were a group of us, Jews, Muslims, and Christians, working together about nuclear armaments. We'd had a particularly important moment, and the senior rabbi in our group said, I'm just noticing how I feel much more kinship with the people in this room than I do with some of my co-religionists. All of us began to nod our heads because I, as a Christian, you, as a Muslim, he, as a Jew, have all experienced the phenomenon of co-religionists hijacking our religion. Mm-hmm. You speak about those terrorists who hijacked Islam on 9/11. That Jesus has me call him my brother. Florida preacher mm-hmm. who wants to burn Qurans. Mm-hmm. All these guys are people, are hijacking our religions. Mm-hmm. So
I hear you make this call for us to go deeper with one another. Mm-hmm. I hear you actually make a call to, and I think this is the project that I'm involved in right now, is reinterpreting the scripture from an interreligious lens, mm-hmm. which is what you've done by that beautiful exegesis of the Good Samaritan. What does your heart tell you about what are we going to do about our co-religionists who've hijacked our religions?
So I think that's it's a terrific and penetrating question, and I've certainly had those moments as well. But I want to push that a little bit, right? Because I think that the work of interfaith leadership is not just about bringing people who share a lot of things into a room together, even if they pray differently. I think the work of interfaith leadership is actually building bridges between people who think they have very little in common, right? And if we're doing the other work, I think it's important and beautiful work. But I would call it something a little bit different personally, right? So I would call it, say, people of different religious backgrounds for political progressivism or for spiritual enrichment or for liberal theology. All of them I find important movements. I actually think interfaith work is focused on something a little bit different. Mm. It's focused on people who don't think they have an awful lot in common. Mm. People who orient around religion quite differently. And I think that the highly skilled interfaith leader has the ability to build a bridge between an evangelical voting for a Republican candidate and an Episcopalian or a Jew voting for a Democratic candidate who might think that they disagree on 99% of things and finds the 1% that they might agree on, yeah. right? And this is not, let me be very clear. This is not at all to be dismissive of other types of work that bring people from different religions together. Mm-hmm. What concerns me, and I'm going to be really geeky about this, is that what the social science data now tells us, and I'm speaking especially from Robert Putnam, who did a great profile of your church in his book, Better Together. In his most recent book, American Grace, written with David Campbell, he says, listen, 50 years ago, the divide in American society was between Catholics, Protestants, and Jews. Today, the divide is between political conservatives whose religion drives them to their conservatism and secularists and liberals whose religion or secularism puts them in that category. In my view, if interfaith work is furthering and deepening that polarization, it's not doing its job. There are other movements that are bringing people from different religious traditions together to vote for Obama or to articulate liberal theologies, important movements, and I play a role in those movements. Interfaith cooperation is a civic movement that says that the American project is about people from very different backgrounds who disagree on cosmic things, huge things, abortion, where to draw the line in the Middle East, all of these things, and who still build a nation together. And I just have to say, at a time when people around the world from different religions disagree on cosmic things and think that it is a reason to not build a nation together, we gotta model this here, right? We have to be able to write that next chapter in the American project of I pray in ways that you think are wrong, and yet I call you a fellow citizen. I vote in ways that you consider anathema, and yet we will work together in the cleanup effort around Hurricane Sandy. Right? I think that civically focused interfaith cooperation is the center of this work, and it's a very challenging thing to do because, as I tell my staff all the time, my personal progressivism is subsumed to my focus on pluralism in my role as founder and president of Interfaith Youth Corps. When we work with evangelicals at the organization, and we work with lots of them, and I have huge admiration for what Putnam would call the social capital they build in America, I'm not leading with my progressivism. I'm leading with dimensions of my tradition that have resonances with dimensions of their tradition, and I'm saying, what can we do together? And effectively, what I, I hope I'm lifting up is this notion that there are already folks out there building movements for progressivism and liberal theology who come from different religions. I frankly think there are very, very few people right now who are finding ways to build civic bridges between people who are on different sides of the theological or political spectrum. And that's who we hope to be nurturing and raising up and mobilizing at Interfaith Youth Core.
One last question and then a Rumi poem, and then we'll open it up. I think you and I have not talked about this, but I'm a universalist and have a deep bow of respect for the atheist position. Mm-hmm. Because I discover that in my conversation with a lot of atheists, they don't believe in the God that I don't believe in.
Right.
And even if that's not the case, I think it's a very important American position and a human position. You have faith in the name of your organization.
Yeah.
I'm a church, you know, on the street corner here. So what do you say about this call that you've just articulated mm-hmm. to our brothers and sisters who are atheist citizens?
Right. So just a couple of interesting stats. I would say a quarter of our staff would describe, you know, the 35 people who staff Interfaith Youth Core in Chicago would describe themselves as humanists or secularists or atheists or agnostics. And I would say that 25% of the young people in our programs would say the same thing. And frankly, it's not because I had such a large tent idea when I first started Interfaith Youth Core. It's because they elbowed their way to the table and taught me a whole lot in the process. And one of the things they taught me was that they have an investment in building bridges between people who orient around religion differently, including themselves. And that's one of the reasons that I'm starting to use the language, orient around religion differently. Mm. And one of the ways of orienting around religion is humanism or atheism or skepticism. And it's not about whether I think it's right. I mean, part of the definition of a lot of faith commitments is thinking that you have a fullness that other traditions don't have, mm-hmm. right? It's about finding areas of relationship. And so, you know, one of the folks who graduated from our program and just actually put out a great book called Faithiest, which I wrote the foreword for, is a guy named Chris Stedman, who keynoted our Interfaith Leadership Institute here at the University of Southern California, who is a humanist with 2 degrees in religion, 1 from a seminary, who doesn't define his humanism as anti-religious, simply defines it as a belief that there is not a God and that there is an animating philosophy that would call one to seek cooperation, relationships, and enrichment with people from different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And that's what he's most interested in. Mm-hmm. And there's these beautiful stories in this book about how he went through his kind of anti-religious phase, and he was working at a Lutheran-sponsored nursing home in the northern part of Minnesota, and the person he'd made the closest friends with, this elderly man, said to him at one point, will you read this for me? And his eyes had gone bad and couldn't read, and it was from a prayer book. And Chris basically had to make the decision, am I going to read something I don't believe in? And the decision was yes, because I have a relationship with this man, and it's special to him. And honestly, this isn't about me. It's about him. It's not whether I believe this. It's about, am I going to be a friend, right? And that's when you know, his kind of faithism begins, so to speak, which is the ability to recognize that something is special and meaningful and powerful in somebody else's life and finding the dimensions of your own that would resonate with that. So I want to tell just 2 quick stories about that, right? One is from my dad. And the reason I'm in this country and my family's in this country is because the University of Notre Dame let in a middling Indian Muslim student to their MBA program in the 1970s, one Sadhguru Patel, my father, who was a die-deep fighting Irish fan ever since. So have I been. It's been a tough 20 years, but this one's a good one. This year's a good one. So when I was a kid, he would take me to to Notre Dame football games. And our first stop at Notre Dame was at the Grotto, which is a shrine devoted to the Virgin Mary. And, you know, my dad would light a candle, and we would sit in a moment of silence there. And, you know, like 8 or 9 years old, we've been doing this for 3 or 4 years at this point, and something occurs to me. I'm like, hey, Dad, we're Muslim. What the hell are we doing here, right? And my dad put his arm around me, and he said, in the Quran, there is a verse that says God is like a lamp that's in a niche. He is light upon light. And he pointed to the shrine with all these flickering candles, and he said, always look for the resonances. Mm. Always look for the resonances. Right? And so that was so, it wasn't we agree with this. It wasn't this thing is the same. It's there is a resonance in our tradition, in this tradition. And we can pay our respects in this way. And I find that, you know, so beautiful and so moving. End us with Rumi, Reverend Bacon.
So this is a big task that you and I have been talking about, and we're going to open this. And I really love the Noah poem. So you ready for it?
I am ready.
I keep a Rumi file, and I sent it to Ibu, and I said, let's do some Rumi. And he said, well, some of my favorites are in your file, and he named this one among some others. Start a huge, foolish project like Noah. It makes absolutely no difference what people think of you.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you.
Good brother.
Thank you.
So, yeah, we got to hug a minute.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's have some questions.
Mr. Patel, I understand the importance to you of civil bridge building. So I don't understand why you would use the rhetoric of nationalism, I think would bring a lot of limitations. Mm. And did you notice that the song that you like, This Land Is Your Land, is actually a song of a class-based claim for social justice? Mm. Thanks.
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. Thank you for that. So, you know, Richard Rorty, the great Stanford philosopher, wrote this beautiful book called Achieving Our Country. And he begins that book by saying, I'm going to say something that folks who think politically like me generally don't like to hear. And he's a political progressive. He's like, I like patriotism. He says, I think that patriotism plays the same role in nations that self-esteem plays in individuals. Mm. It has the possibility of playing an animating role towards improvement. And that's how I view it, you know. And one of the reasons that I'm so deeply committed to the American project is because I feel like an owner in this nation, right? I get to vote for the people who run the government. I get to start an organization that has a huge, foolish project like making interfaith cooperation a social norm. I've lived in England. I've worked in South Africa. I've done some work in India and Kenya. I love all these places. But I never felt like an owner there. You know, I never felt like my hands could shape that soil. And you know, one of the things I love about Woody Guthrie was just how wide his vision was. And I actually saw Arlo Guthrie, his son, play that song in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, my dad's vision for this song was always sea to shining sea, Pacific to Atlantic, but he knew that you had to go the long way around. Mm-hmm. You know? So I love that. I think that it's a beautiful thing to lift up the heroes of all nations. And I think that we have heroes in America, and I think we ought to recognize them.
Thanks for that question.
Okay. One of the things I've heard commentators say about this presidential election is that it's one of the rare times in history where faith and religion has been downplayed.
Yeah.
Because it's apparently a problem for both candidates. Apparently being a Mormon is a problem.
Yeah.
And being a Christian that people think is a Muslim is also a problem. So
yeah.
Both candidates have kind of not spoken about it. And so kind of off of interfaith, it's kind of no faith is being kind of portrayed because they can't even talk about it. And I'm curious about your thoughts about that.
I think that's a terrific question. Thank you for that. So, you know, there's, although it might not be part of the explicit discourse, meaning the kind of the presidential debates type stuff, there's plenty of it going on behind the scenes and just below the radar screen. So, you know, both campaigns have very strong kind of build religious coalitions efforts going on, which I think are really positive, right? So part of what's, I view it as really positive that this campaign is a huge step towards the mainstreaming of the Mormon tradition in America. And a key advancer of that are evangelical Christians. Mm. Now, one can say for a variety of reasons that this is a relationship built on political convenience, but frankly, this is the Putnam stuff. You start somewhere, right? So a large community of Americans, and by the way, evangelicals are somewhere between a third and 40% of America. That is a huge part of our nation. And one of the lines I have in Sacred Ground is, when evangelicals change, America changes. Evangelical views around Catholics changed over the course of the past 40 years or so. That was a huge advancer to the mainstreaming of Catholics in America. Evangelical views of Mormons are changing in part because of Mitt Romney's candidacy, a huge mainstreaming of Mormons in America. I have a number of stories in this book, actually, about relationships that evangelicals are building with Muslims. And I talk a lot about my friend, Reverend Bob Roberts, Southern Baptist preacher in Texas, who during the Ground Zero Mosque crisis, I thought that John Stewart and Nick Kristof went out on a limb with how supportive they were of Muslims. But Bob Roberts, in deep red Texas, started tweeting 10 things I love about Muslims, 10 things I admire about Islam. And I'm like, why are you doing this? He's like, I'm a Christian. This is what I got to do. Your people are in trouble, and I have to stand up for you, right? So I find that I disagree with Bob on just about everything. But he built a civic bridge with me based on the inspiration of his tradition. And that kind of stuff, I think, again, is going on a little bit below the radar screen, a little bit behind the scenes in both campaigns, and I think it's a broadly positive thing for America.
What do you think is the biggest roadblock that your organization or interfaith groups are facing today, and what do you think are some one or two solutions that people in this room can help with removing those roadblocks?
Yeah, what a great question. Thank you for that. And, you know, Ed, hard questions I always ask my friends to answer first. So why don't you take this one first, and then give me a chance to think about it.
The deepest answer I have is the fear of democracy that is in our country. I agree with Ibu that the idea of America is one that will prevail. You allude to the arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward, and you talk about inclusion. Dr. King was talking about justice, and I think that's absolutely right. And I think the arc of the universe is long, and it bends toward democracy, and it needs people like you and me and all of you working to bend it. And the biggest obstruction we have is this deep fear of the democracy of souls. Because people don't understand, I think, that when you share power, you actually increase your power. It's like giving your light to another candle. You don't lose your light. You keep it. That's been my experience so far. Do you have enough time to shape an answer?
I think so. It's a little bit more earth level than yours. I think ours live together well, though. Look, I think we're at the beginning of a new movement, right? The multiculturalism movement has been built over the past 50 or 60 years. You can trace it back to multiple points. You can trace it back to Jackie Robinson in 1948. You can trace it back to King in Montgomery in 1955. You can trace it back to, you know, Brown versus Board in 55. We're at the beginning of this chapter of the interfaith movement. And I think that the single most important thing we need right now is people to see themselves not as participants but as leaders. Right, I was teaching a class at USC yesterday, and I'm talking about the importance of the interfaith triangle, and somebody was like, you know, where are the programs I would apply to for that? And I'm like, you got to build those.
Yeah.
And now, if you're a student and you want to apply to do some international development effort, there are 100 programs. But if you wanted to do that 50 years ago, there wasn't that many.
Yeah.
People built an infrastructure of international development, an infrastructure of multiculturalism, an infrastructure of environmentalism. I think that we are at the beginning of that, and the most important thing that we need right now are people to view themselves as leaders, right? So right now, the conversation about religion is dominated by three discourses. Religion poisons everything, religions are fated to fight, and the Muslims are coming to get you. If that's the conversation that's going to continue happening unless you stand up and change that conversation. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, you need to have something of an appreciative knowledge of other traditions, right? And something of a theology of interfaith cooperation or an ethic of interfaith cooperation or an ethic of pluralism if you're a humanist, you know, so that you can change that conversation, so you can start that kind of a program. That's one of the reasons that we at IFYC choose to focus on college students, because it's easy to start programs on college campuses, right? So you know, of course, there's things that go along with that. There needs to be a funding base for this movement. I hate to say it, but there is a huge funding base for religious extremism. I can't wait until the day that major foundations in America who currently have programs in environmentalism or human rights or, you know, gender equality issues, where they say, we're going to give away $50 million in this, or education reform, where the MacArthur Foundation or the Ford Foundation or Eli Broad here in L.A. says, I'm going to invest $25 million in interfaith cooperation efforts this year, and I'm going to focus on the ones that have that are showing measurable success. That's how we build a movement. But I think the hill is steeper when you're at the beginning, and obviously the climb is longer, but there's a lot of beauty to being at the beginning, to being a pioneer of this right now.
I do think it's important to say that there is an industry of Islamophobia. There is an industry of fear in this country, and I think we really need to be very practical and not be in denial of that, and that's simply a punctuation of what you just said.
I wonder whether you could remind us of the three vertices of your triangle and say a word or two about how we might implement or advance those three different principles in our daily lives.
Sure. Thank you for that. So relationships, knowledge, attitudes, and it's based on the social science data that shows that these three things are linked. And so knowledge, you know, one of the ways comes from reading books about this stuff, right? So you would read books that would give you an appreciative knowledge of Islam or Judaism or a range of religions. And the nice thing about it is that you walk into any decent bookstore and there's a pretty large selection of books on this. And relationships are, you know, Sheikh Hamza would say, people are always asking, where are the Muslims in America? They're your doctors, is his joke, right? And that's only actually, frankly, partly a joke. To ask the question of our neighbors about their traditions, humanism or Hinduism, I think is a beautiful thing, and I'll tell you why. Because the reason the question is too often not asked is because we think that the conversation is naturally going to veer towards divisiveness. But that's only because those of us who seek to ask the question appreciatively have not asked the question. So the only voices out there are the voices of divisiveness. The methodology at Interfaith Youth Core is the simplest thing in the world. You take a set of shared civic values, which are also religious values, compassion, hospitality, service, and you put them at the center of the table and you ask the question, tell me about what it is from your tradition that inspires you to connect to this. And a five-year-old can answer that question, not because he or she could quote from the Quran or the Hebrew Bible, but because they could say, my mom says, or my pastor says, my sons could answer that question. Right, my daddy prays with us every night, and after the formal prayer, he says to God, please give your mushkila san and your sakina, your easing of difficulties and your compassionate justice to those suffering in the world. We Muslims believe in helping those who are suffering in the world. Right, so to organize knowledge gathering and conversations around how does your tradition or belief system speak to hospitality. The beautiful thing about that, we've learned from 10 years of doing this at Interfaith Youth Corps, is it invites what we call the mutually enriching conversation rather than the mutually exclusive one. Mm. You know, you don't have to go to, people ask me all the time, but you're not talking about the elephant in the room, the Middle East or abortion. And I'm like, you want to know why? Because there's other animals in the zoo. Mm. And I'm not pretending the elephant doesn't exist, mm-hmm. but I don't want every animal to look like the elephant because it's not. There are other things in Muslim-Jewish relations than the Middle East. That doesn't mean the Middle East isn't important. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. But frankly, a conversation about the Middle East is likely to be much more civil and humane if we talk about the similarities between tzedakah and tahzakah, right? The Jewish notion of charity or compassionate justice and the Muslim notion. So, on our website, ifyc.org, we have something called an interfaith literacy quiz. That might be fun for you to do with your book group or your community or whatever it might be. But I would invite folks to go to that. We also have a bunch of great resources on that site that I think people can use, ifyc.org.
You're wishing for new leaders to come out of this. And many times to be a leader is to be lonely. And a lot of people that are ingrained in their religious community, if they like the idea of interfaith cooperation, they might be fighting against the community that they're in. And to become lonely in that sense, to be apart from their community, how do you address that for these young people in college, for people that are in this room as well?
What a terrific question. I'd love to hear your thinking on that. I'm happy to affirm the question and kick it to you.
Well, it is a crucial question. I've written a book. I don't know if you know this, but it's called 8 Habits of Love.
I've heard.
Have you?
Yeah.
And part of it deals with the fact that when we are leaders, we have to go through a lot of transformation ourselves. And those moments of transformation really are lonely. And for me, now this is going to be religious and spiritual and mystical, but for me, it's very important for someone to access the divinity within and for that to be your closest friend, most reliable friend. Not to replace community, but to enrich community and also to be there when your communities oftentimes are changing, or your communities are making a decision whether or not you're still going to belong to that community. That's one thing. The other thing is, in my loneliest moments when I've made transitions, and I've made an awful lot of transitions in my life, not only religiously, but in terms of the way I think, it has been very important for me to have friends in another place. Let's take Ibu and me. My sense is that we will remain friends forever. There might be lonely times that I would go through and that he would go through in the future, but my conviction actually is that I could reach out and say, this is going on. Are you still there for me? And I think that's really important for all of us to have a network of people who may not be immediately in our community, but we can touch through email or voicemail or something like that.
Yeah, thank you for that. So one of the things that we try to do, and actually we do at IFYC, is that we're very deliberate about building that community, right? So Interfaith Leadership Institutes are a time when we're bringing together 100 to 150 students on a campus, helping them see themselves as interfaith leaders, right? Training them in the knowledge base and the skill set, and basically setting them up to say, we promise you this is not going to be as successful as you might hope it's going to be. Mm. And look around at all of these other people from all of these other campuses and know that they're going through the same thing. Mm. That the panel discussion they put 6 weeks into planning was attended by 10 people, right? That the interfaith service project that they planned got rained out, right? So know that you have a network of people to improve and nurture your interfaith leadership skills with. And we're building that community very deliberately. And we call it an identity category, right? They're a human rights activist. That's an identity category. Environmentalist, social entrepreneur. These are a variety of identity categories. And we think interfaith leader kind of deserves that same mind space for people to say, I'm a Christian or a Baha'i or a Buddhist or a Muslim or a Jew or a humanist, and I'm an interfaith leader. I'll say one more thing on this, and this is close to what Ed was saying as well. I tell this story about this young woman named Audrey Alice at the end of my book. It's the final story in the book, where she's an intern at Interfaith Youth Corps a couple of summers ago, and frankly, the quietest of our interns. And you know, I met with this group of interns at the end of the summer, and I said, you know, so you've been trained to be an interfaith leader over the course of several months, and you've hung around with IFYC staff, and you've done interfaith service projects every Thursday night. What are you going to do when you go back to your own community? And Audrey was the only one who didn't really have an answer, right? So she goes back to her community, and a couple months later, she gets a chain email as part of her church communities that says 10 reasons why Muslims can't be American. And the first one is, you know, they believe in the moon god Hunbal or something like that. And I'm like, we believe in Allah, right? I mean, at least get the name right, you know? And it's 10 reasons. And Audrey writes back, I spent the summer with a group of people from different religions who are, and some of them were Muslim, and I did service projects with them, and I watched them pray, and they watched me pray, and I built this relationship with them, and I just don't think it's something our church that should be doing to send this email around, this chain email around. And she's like, you have no idea the hate mail I received in response. Things like, are you going to Mecca University? Where's your Muslim lady costume? Are you joining the terrorists? She's like, I was baptized in this church. I've been going to this church for 17 years, you know? And my staff brought this to my attention, and I was worried. I was like, you know, I don't want to be responsible for separating a girl from her church community or from her tradition. I called her. I'm like, Audrey, I'm really sorry about what happened. And, you know, let me know if I can do anything. Can I call your pastor? Can I call your parents? I imagine like this has caused this huge schism. And she's like, these have been the most difficult 2 weeks of my life. And I'm like, I can just imagine. Long pause. This was the most Christian thing I've ever done. Right? Really beautiful. She's like, I know what I'm doing next. I'm going to seminary. Why do I tell that story in response to your question? Because that's when she went back to the Bible, that kept her company. This notion of this is what I feel called to do. This is why traditions are so powerful, right? This is why I write so much about the American tradition of pluralism in Sacred Ground. And I don't hide the prejudice. I mean, the reason the pluralism had to be strong was because the prejudice was so ugly. But man, is it powerful to know that the Prophet Muhammad stood up for the funeral of a Jew in respect. Man, is it powerful to know that Dietrich Bonhoeffer said on German radio during the Holocaust that those who did not stand up for the Jews do not deserve to sing Gregorian chants. That you're kind of kept company by what Cornel West would call these kind of angels at your back, the wind of these traditions at your back. And you know, we tell our students this, that you have to access that. You have to access that because this is going to be lonely and it's going to be hard work.
One of my favorite passages in the New Testament says, the one who is within you is greater than the one who is in the world. And there's a wonderful spiritual that I was taught in the civil rights movement that sings, friends don't treat me like they used to since I laid my burden down. And to lay down the burden of prejudice and narrow-mindedness is a huge burden to lay down, and there will be a time when those friends you had as friends don't treat you like they used to. and this accessing what my friend Layla teaches me about God consciousness.
Taqwa, yeah.
Yeah, to access that. When this Florida pastor wanted to burn Qurans, I said, I was on the gym on a bike, you know, doing my cardio, and I was reading this and in the New York Times, and I said, and it came to me, we shouldn't be burning Qurans, we should be reading Qurans. And so we put together this program of three of my closest Muslim friends to come and talk about what the Quran means to me. And Layla came and spoke. And I asked her why she does what she does. And she said, oh, it's to keep my God consciousness alive. And I think that's what we're talking about in part, yeah. To keep that God consciousness alive, which you know will never abandon you when your friends might.
Do you have a Rumi poem that you want to end with, this beautiful conversation?
Do you have one? I have, you could do that last one on the second page if you wanted.
Why don't you do that? These are yours.
Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there's a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. This is a great book. I hope you'll buy it. Thank you all very
Thank
much
you.
For being here.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.